And first off, everyone, I wanted to introduce myself. My name is Ernest Priestley, and I'm the founder of Moms Fighting Autism. And we are very, very fortunate today to have Chantal Kira, if that's the correct pronunciation there. She's just a wonderful speaker, and she's a very prolific author. We're going to hear so much from her today. Let me give you sort of a brief background here of her. She's been involved with the autism spectrum disorder for over 20 years, and she has a very special perspective because her son is also on the spectrum. She happens to speak French very fluently, and she has lived in three countries, France, UK, and the United States, where she raised her son. So she's intimately familiar with all the procedures there. She currently hosts a radio show in English and also in French on Autism One Radio. And Chantal also writes for various publications, including Ask Chantal, which is a column for the Autism File, and she blogs occasionally on the Huffington Post. Her family has been highlighted in the Newsweek cover story, Growing Up with Autism, and she was featured on the MTV documentary, A True Life Series, called I Have Autism, which she was a recipient of a 2008 Voice Award. She's also an author of three books. Her first book on autism spectrum disorder, A Complete Guide to Understanding Autism, Asperger's Syndrome, Pervasive Developmental Disorder, and other ASDs, was a recipient of the 2005 Autism Society of America's Outstanding Literary Work on the of the Year Award. And she was also nominated for the 2005 Penn Martha Airbrand Award for First Nonfiction. Her second book was titled Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum, A Parent's Guide on the Cognitive, Social, Physical, and Transition Needs of Teenagers with Autism Spectrum Disorder, was awarded the 2006 San Diego Book Award for Best in Health Fitness. And her third book is coming up here very shortly. She's going to tell us a little bit about that, but it has to do with communication, safety, and self-esteem. And it's an interesting book that she's going to talk a little bit about. And she also has a very special announcement to make later on in the call, so you want to stick around and hear that. I think I covered everything, Chantal.
I think you did, except you got my name wrong, but that's okay.
Oh, no. What did I do? What should have been?
My name is Chantal Kira.
Oh, okay. The hyphen. I forgot about that. Okay.
It's really important because people are looking me up or people used to my name. They're going, who is she? I never heard of her before. But if you say the whole thing, people go, oh, I might have heard of her.
Understand. Okay. Well, I tell you, it's really exciting to have everyone here today. We have people from all around the United States today and across the world that are listening on the call right now. And I guess perhaps you want to tell us a little bit about kind of what you're working on and what you're up to. Kind of give people maybe a little better idea of sort of, you know, what your relationship, what struggles you had with your son, so people get kind of a perspective of where you're coming from.
First of all, I want to say thank you for inviting me to be here, and I am really happy to be here, and I hope you didn't mind me teasing you about saying my name wrong. And actually, when you said all those things about me, I'm thinking, is he really talking about me? Because if I had thought 5 years ago that I would be in this place now, I wouldn't believe it, because you know, I worked in the field of autism a long time ago, and then I had my son when I was living in Europe, and there were no resources at the time and in those countries, and which is what kind of led me to write my first book, was really to help the people, because I didn't want the people to go through what I had gone through when my son was little. And I just kept writing to provide more information to parents, because that's what I really enjoyed doing. So the kinds of things I'm involved with right now are basically the same thing, getting information out to people, which is why I continue to write, which is why I do the radio show for Autism One, which is on the internet, and it's free to everyone. So I really like to talk about that. And also why I write this Ask Chantal column for this magazine called The Autism File. About 2 or 3 years ago, I was thinking, oh, wouldn't it be neat to have like a Dear Abby column somewhere for people who have kids with autism? Because how many times do you have this question that you don't know who to direct to or you really want an answer?
Right.
And Dear Abby sounds like the perfect person. And so I was always thinking, like in the back of my mind, maybe one day I could do that. And this UK magazine called The Autism File contacted me and asked if I would write. In England, they call them agony ants. A Dear Abby is an agony aunt, I guess, because you write and tell them your agonies. So I wrote, so Well, I agreed to write this column, and now this magazine is coming to the States, so that's something we can talk about later. But anyway, so that's why I write the Ask Chantal column.
Very good.
I continue to do all of that, but the most important job in my life right now is helping my son, because he's in the last 2 years of where he will be eligible for special education services. You know, he's turning 20 in January, and up until the age of 22, he will have access to and support, you know, help for his education. So that's what I'm really focusing on.
Very good. Very good. Well, that's a great background here. I mean, I think people here are getting an idea of kind of where you're coming from. You know, you've experienced these things firsthand, and then you've had the opportunity to write about them too, which I think is really good. Gives everyone an idea of kind of what you're up to here, and I really like the way you explained it all. Do you want to get involved in some questions right now? We've got quite a few coming in.
I'd love to answer.
Okay. Let's see here. I'm going to find a question here. Here we go. My son, her name is Elisa Tarkington from Columbia, South Carolina, and her question is, my son has been diagnosed with high-functioning autism. He is 8 years old. I have been trying to get a diagnosis since he was 3 when I realized something was wrong. At what age do most high-functioning kids get a diagnosis? You're familiar with that one.
Right. That's a really good question, and usually they do tend to get diagnosed at around 8 or 9 years old, those with Asperger's, or technically it would have to be Asperger's, and I'll explain the difference between Asperger's and high-functioning autism in a second. But the reason why they do that is because, I don't know how many people are familiar, you know, who have neurotypical children, who have worked with children, is in the school, you tend to do the same things every day, and you have the same patterns, and then, you know, they give you homework when you're in second grade that you return the next day. When you start to be around the age of 8, that's when in the classroom they start organizing things differently so that they give you a homework packet maybe on Monday, and some of the things are due the next day, but there's a project that's going to be due at the end of the week, for example. And this is when they start noticing that kids with Asperger's, like you might have noticed a little bit of difficulties in different areas, but it's when they totally fall apart, it's because of their organizational skills. And so this is why at that time, it's also the time that little peer groups start happening to get together more in school, that you know, people really are starting to have their little cliques. And so that's right. Why you notice it. And the difference, the technical difference between high-functioning autism and Asperger's has to do with whether or not the child develops language normally or not. In other words, if they speak before the age of 2, technically they're supposed to have an Asperger's diagnosis, and if they do not develop speech before the age of 2, then that's when you would have the high-functioning autism diagnosis.
Okay. I see the difference.
But in the end, it looks the same. I mean, there's varying degrees, but Tony Atwood, who is an expert on Asperger's syndrome, he likes to say that the only difference between high-functioning autism and Asperger's syndrome is the way it's spelled.
That's a great explanation. I have one more question here. Thanks a lot for that answer. I have one more question here. My name is Keenan from upstate New York. Interesting question here. It says, my son, or my 10-year-old son, constantly hits himself in the face. Why is this, and how can we stop this behavior?
Okay. He's constantly hitting himself in the face. I guess it's hard to know when the question's just there, but have they looked to see if there's any antecedent, like it only happens at certain times, or have they not? So the first thing that I would say is try to see if there's a reason why. For example, observe. When he hits his face, what happened immediately before? And see if there's any pattern that evolves over a week or so. The other thing that I would say, and I don't want to say that everyone's like my son, but my son tends to do that every once in a while, but I find that my son has many sensory processing challenges, and with him it's linked to that, because he'll hit his face once in a while, the same way he'll hit his chest once in a while, and it's sort of this need for deep pressure and a calming influence. Sensory-wise. But that doesn't mean
right.
It's true for everyone. for somebody else,
right.
they might be slapping their face because they're mad about something, and that's why, or there's something that's irritating them, like maybe there was a sharp noise at that side of the room right near their ear, or something happened right before, and that's their only way they have of communicating. You know, they haven't figured out how to put it in words if they're able to express themselves. And so it's good to see if there's a pattern first before analyzing what to do about it.
Understood. Okay, that's a great answer. Let me get here to another one. Her name is Heather Harden Oaks, and her question is, I have a 21-year-old son with Asperger's. He seems to be more rude and insensitive than ever. Is this an isolated case, or do some of the negative behaviors increase with age?
There's really no research on that, but I can say just from my travels and from what I read and hear about and listen to is that a lot of times people with Asperger's, as they get older, sometimes will get more frustrated because they realize this is one thing that has been shown in research, that there is a higher incidence of depression linked to Asperger's as they get older, and we think that it's probably because they realize as they get older that they're different than their peers, and so
mm-hmm.
that frustrates them or makes them sad. And so some of the people who may seem like they're, as you described his behaviors, it may be simply that he is really unhappy, that they could be signs of depression, and that is his way of getting it out. I don't know what his life situation is, but it could be that he's having difficulties with realizing that he is different from other people.
Sure. Well, let's see here. We've got another one here that just came in. Her name is Stacy, and she's from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. Her question is, an interesting question, it says, how do I get the school to work with me and not fight with me about how to work with my son?
Oh, boy.
I'm sure you can talk about that one a long time, and I'm willing, and I'd love you to do it.
That's a great question. I'm not sure how many people are familiar because if they've read my books or seen Jeremy on MTV, but my son is very much on the very impacted end of the spectrum. And so my fight has always been to try and have people believe that he is smart enough to learn something, and if they can't teach him, then it's because we haven't found the way to teach him. All this saying, by the way, that I had no idea how much my son really understood or not, but I wanted him to reach as his potential, whatever that may be. And so my way of dealing has always been more of a mediator because that's kind of my background. Having been raised in a French environment in America and then having to be a social worker where you're trying to get what people need, but you have to do it in a way that's politically correct, and then moving to France where I worked with French and Americans and they never understood each other, so I always tried to get everybody working together. I find myself doing the same thing in IEP meetings, and I also realized from my life experience work-wise that you get more with sugar than with vinegar.
Yeah.
And I would always know that expression, you get more flies, you catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. And so I would always, what I would do is figure out the one or two things that would really make a difference in my son's education, and I would arm myself with facts and figures, and I would always discuss things in a non-emotional manner.
Sure.
When it comes to IEP meetings, that's very important, because an IEP meeting basically is a business meeting, and you have to convince them, and you're not going to convince them just because your kid deserves this. It's really about why you think something would work for your child and how it has helped other people, and maybe you've tried it at home and it's worked. There's that. And also in the classrooms, I have found that most of, you know, sometimes you get aides or teachers that are really, you know, very old-fashioned or just waiting to leave, but most of the people that I've had to deal with are people who, you know, hey, they came into special education because they love kids, not because they're going to make $1 million. So the point is, how can you support them in seeing the light when it comes to your child? So one way I was able to do that was give them one or two little things that they could try with my son that would work, or show them what I did at home, because then they'd be amazed at how much more my son did at home than he did at school. So if I could get a home visit out of it, or a tape record, I mean, videotape, document. The other thing is that I would also find out what it is that the teacher needed in the classroom, because I soon found out that when you're in IEP meetings, my first experience when I moved back to the States with Jeremy at IEP meetings was the school district administrator would say, oh yes, we can do that, can't we, Mrs. Johnson? And they asked Mrs. Johnson, the teacher, couldn't she do this, this, and this? And of course she would have to say yes, because the school district administrator is her boss. But she
right.
did not have what she needed to follow through with my son. And
sure.
so that, I soon found out, was like a trap. So what I would do is make friends with the teacher and find out, what is it that you need in your classroom that's going to make you able to provide, you know, the education my son needs? And then when I'd find out what that was, then I would go to IEP meetings and ask for these things, but leaving the teacher out of it, so they all thought it was for me, because the thing that you have to realize is the parent has all the power.
Right.
The teachers have no power. But you do have to be in a situation where people are going to listen, and I have been in situations where school administrators, no matter what you say, they're not going to listen, so I have ended up in due process. But I always start with trying to support the teacher and the aides, because they're the ones
sure.
in the front line.
Right. Yeah, because that's the best way to get them with honey there, for sure, to talk with the teacher and get them to help you out. That's a good way to, that's a good approach there. Matter of fact, on Wednesday, we actually have a teleseminar on IEPs from an attorney who's specializes
right.
specifically in IEPs, which is going to be great. So for those of you on the call, you know, don't forget to miss that.
Right, and the thing that I want to say about attorneys, I have used attorneys in the past, and attorneys are great. The only thing you want to remember is that when it's all said and done, even if you win, the attorney leaves, and you are left to pick up the pieces and make and get those relationships back going again. So you want to
exactly.
make sure that the attorney is helping your case, but is not ruining your relationships.
Right, right. Good point. Really good point.
You might want to bring that up in the meeting. I'm sure this attorney will have suggestions on how do you keep good relationships in these kinds of situations.
Oh, yes.
And I do want to say, too, because sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, she's written 3 books and she's an expert, so she doesn't have any problems with her school district. That is not at all the case. Just like Temple Grandin, I don't know if you're familiar with Temple Grandin, who wrote... Temple Grandin has written the forewords to my books, and she's written Thinking in Pictures. She's probably the world's most famous person with autism, or woman with autism. And she always told me, you're never an expert in your own backyard. She designs stock, those handling facilities for animals before they go off to slaughterhouses, before they go off to get killed to be hamburgers at McDonald's. And she has never worked in a stockyard in her home state. And it's the same thing with my IEPs, my son's IEPs here in my school district. It doesn't matter if I've written a book or if I'd written 500 books. I don't know anything. You know, people may pay me money to across the country to go and give them advice on what to do in their school districts, but my school district doesn't want to hear from me.
Wow. You know, that's good. I'm glad you said that, because I know a lot of parents out there are struggling, you know, with this very same thing. You know, they feel like it's you know, the whole world against them, and they feel alone, and you know, it's you sort of put it out there that, you know, it's you just have to stick to it all the time, no matter if you're reading one book or no book or whatever. You know, you just got to get in there and you know, do what you can for your child. I like that.
Right.
So,
I always try to do it you know, in a very positive manner. And before I got to the step of hiring an attorney, which I had to at one point, because it came to abusive situation in the classroom, so, I mean, you know, that clearly for me is a line I do not cross.
Right.
And so at that point, before ever hiring an advocate or an attorney, I suggest that people get a hold of their every state has a protection and advocacy agency. You can Google it, and you can get simplified explanation of what your rights are under special education. And so in California, I would download it and print it out, and I would carry that to my meetings so people would know, oh, she knows something.
Right.
Anyway, I'm not going to talk about IEPs because you have a gentleman who's more knowledgeable than I am in that arena.
Well,
but
actually, no, I don't mind because I think, you know, I really don't mind because, you know, you can look at it from the perspective of someone who's work with IEPs, using an attorney and also without an attorney. So, you know, that's a great perspective to have.
You know what I like to do? I like to go to meetings with solutions.
Right.
Like, I have problems, here's a solution.
Right.
So, that's what I try to do, too.
Very good. Very good.
And, again, it really does depend on who's sitting around the table.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that, because usually it's the teacher, it's some person from the regional center, and then it's you, and then maybe, you know, whoever you have with you.
Well, I always tell people, and I used to do a IEP 101 workshop for people in my area. Put that on with the person who's an advocate, and we used to do this because I thought this is what new parents need to know, how to have an effective IEP. And it is very hard when you go into an IEP at the beginning because it's you, and then it's the teacher, a school administrator. Usually there's going to be, like, the speech pathologist, an occupational therapist. You feel like it's a lot of people and that you're all by yourself. So I always say, first of all, never go by yourself. And if both parents, let's say it's a single-parent situation or only one parent can go because, you know, we have jobs, right? And so always go with a friend, even if they're just going to take notes for you. And also, this is what I always do because, you know, I told you I'm a mediator, right? So I always want the meeting to feel good. And my problem is I forget that this is not about feeling good and that I have to remember what are the three or four things that I did not want to negotiate on or that I need to make sure are taken care of, which means there has to be, you know, what's going to happen, when it's going to take place, and who's responsible. So I always have the person with me, whether it's my husband or a girlfriend, right? I give her a list before I go in there, and she is supposed to kick me in under the table and point to the person to remind me, you didn't get an answer on this, or, you know, stop talking about that, get back to this. And and she also takes notes for me because I'm so busy listening to everybody that you might forget some crucial information.
Right.
So those are just my basics.
No, I'm glad you mentioned these things because I think this is a great takeaway for people out there is that, you know, bring someone with you.
Yeah, because, you know, it's tough. And also you want to go in there looking professional, you know, like clean clothes and, you know, your papers in order. And the thing is, don't be nervous because they all look like they've been in it for a long time. But remember this, they have 500 million kids that they're trying to remember things about. You just have your child. So you go in there and you'll know more information about your child than they do. You're the expert on your child. And I always try to turn everything that's negative into a positive. For example, once this assessment came back about my son, and I look at this and I'm thinking, this isn't even the right assessment. It was supposed to be a functional analysis assessment and that they had wanted to do. And I thought, oh, my God, what is this? This gives no information. It doesn't answer the question. And I'm thinking, how could this be? And I start reading at the beginning, and I realize they did a whole different assessment. And if I looked at it from the point of view of it's a different assessment, all of a sudden I realized, you know, this person actually spent a lot of time, and this person actually worked really hard at writing this. So I went into the meeting not angry. I just said, you know, I have a feeling that this is not the assessment that we really need that's going to help the teacher understand my son better. You know, I think what we need is a XYZ assessment because this I thought was going to be the functional behavioral assessment. It isn't, though. So,
describe
and before
the
I
functional,
just came before, you know, but I think, you know, and so then the district person said, oh, yeah, you're right. This isn't really telling us about his behaviors, is it? And then the next thing you know, I had also done my homework and found out who are the three people in the area that parents said wrote very nice assessments, you know, who knew what they were doing, that they were happy with the assessments for their children when it came to, you know, a functional behavioral assessment. And I decided I would hope that they would pick one of those three people. Well, the district person came back and said, what if we ask so-and-so to do this assessment? And so I could have gotten in there angry, but I decided that I had to look at the positive. And the positive was somebody spent a lot of time writing that report and doing observations, and it was a well-written report. Unfortunately, it did not answer the question.
Right.
So you just got to try and think one step ahead. How are you going to make something positive out of a negative?
Sure. Could you describe for us what an individual assessment is?
What a functional behavioral assessment is?
Yes.
That's,
people,
if I can pronounce it correctly, I've said it like three different ways. functional behavioral assessment is when someone who's qualified, usually someone who has an ABA background or a psychologist, will come in and observe the child to see what behaviors the child is exhibiting and why he's showing those behaviors. So, for example, earlier when we were talking about the mother who had the question about why her child is hitting himself in the face, if someone was doing a functional behavioral assessment, they would look at what function does that behavior have? Why is he hitting himself in his face? What happens before, what happened during, what happened after? What's the antecedent, which is what happened before? What's the behavior and what's the consequence? Mm. And then it's important to look at the consequence, what happens afterwards, because sometimes it's what's happening afterwards is rewarding the child for exhibiting certain behaviors. So once you do a functional behavior analysis, you have an idea of what the behaviors are that are happening and why someone thinks they're taking place because of what's happened before or during or after. Then the most important part is creating the plan to deal with it. So, for example, you might look at toileting in the same way. You know, when you're having toileting, you might do a functional behavioral assessment of the whole toileting issue so that you can solve any problems that there are.
All right. Very good. That was a long answer for a very short question about the school. That means that you have a lot of experience in this area here about school, which is fantastic because people want to hear that.
Hope you're not trying to tell me I talk too much.
No, heavens no, not at all. I'm glad you're talking because we've gotten a couple of questions that have come up just as you were talking.
I'd love to hear them.
Okay, let's see. Let me just quickly go here. Here we go. This question is from Stacy Lewis. How can I make the transition from the summer daycare to school so that he stops being so aggressive? The last 2 weeks of summer, the daycare thinks he's, I'm sorry, I'm trying to rephrase here, thinks it's something that he's doing bad behavior-wise, is not able to handle with all the teacher and student changes. I think maybe she was typing a little fast here. I guess the gist of it is, how can I make the transition from summer daycare to school, which
so
parents are facing this a lot.
Not going well? Does it sound like from the letter?
This is a question that she just posted, I think.
Okay, well, you know, I can answer about how you make transitions easier. And it is true that it is hard if that some kids do act out with transition. Transition is the number one problem with people on the spectrum. And I'm going to answer directly that question, but I just want to say that this was really brought into me very strongly when I interviewed people on the spectrum for my third book, which is coming out in October, which is called Autism Life Skills. I interviewed people on the spectrum to find out what was it in growing up that was important to them, what made their life easier, what made them learn the essential skills that they have today, what made them be able to live as adults and be happy about it. And one of the things they talked about why transitions were so difficult is that a lot of the transition stuff has to do with sensory, not being able to predict what's going to be in the environment and that's going to affect them. I could not believe how much sensory processing affected everyone, including everyone on the more able end of the spectrum. And I'm making a point of this because we always talk about sensory processing, especially when we talk about kids like my son who are more impacted by autism. But every single adult with Asperger's that I interviewed for my book talked enormously about the impact of the sensory processing environment when they were growing up. And so the number one thing that everyone said helped them was letting them know what was going to happen next. And we talk a lot about that when we talk about schedules, but it's not just about schedules. I mean, I know when, you know, 10 years ago we used to talk about schedules. We used to say, okay, it has to be icons, it has to be on the wall. But it's anything that explains what's going to happen next. So, for example, how old did you say this child is?
Let's see here. I'm trying to find the question here. I was just scrolling down. Let's see.
Anyway, it would be the same. You would just do it at what would be more age level or developmental level appropriate. But the first thing I would do, if you're changing environments, is to have a book that you take pictures of where they're going, you videotape where they're going. Even if you can't get inside the building, outside the building. You also take them on walks or take them to where they'll be going. So, for example, and you can do this when they're very little or you can do this when they're teenagers. Even when they're very able teenagers, it's such a stress. One of the things the adults said was that even in high school, they got so stressed by trying to get to their classes in time that they completely couldn't even focus on the academic subject that they were listening to. They were just worried about how they were going to get to the next class. So you take them so they can walk through the school or around the school or at least see the outside of it when it's empty, when there's no classes going on. Try to get inside when it's empty as well. That's one thing. When it comes to new staff, are you able to get pictures of the new staff or meet them beforehand? And then every day or every evening, talk about what's going to happen before it happens, like you're going to start school. Even if you don't think your child can understand, okay, you're talking to a mom here whose kid, I was told, you're going to put him in an institution, he doesn't understand anything. It turns out my son understands everything that we're saying to him. He just couldn't communicate it. And so all these years he's been listening. And you don't know if your children are listening or understanding or what, so you always assume that they're understanding. And you use words, and you also use visuals, because you don't know, especially when they're young, if their visual processing is working or their auditory processing is working.
Yeah.
So you want to prepare them by telling them what's going to happen, who they're going to see. And if you tell them every day beforehand, and you have a calendar up so you visually show, you know, today's Friday, and on Monday you're going to a new school, and you talk in a positive experience, in a positive manner about these new experiences, that's how you're best going to prepare your child. And then you want to make sure that your child has familiar items with them. So, for example, if there are certain things your child absolutely loves to eat or have, make sure they have that with them. And you can tell them, too, when you go to school, I'm going to make sure you have the same thing. You know, you're going to eat the same things you like to eat. You're going to have the same lunchbox. Something that they have that's the same.
No, that's helpful. This is really, really good, because as parents are taking their kids, you know, from home to school very shortly here, that information is very, very powerful. I mean, be able to go in and take photographs of the school, take photographs of the staff, and essentially walk them through exactly what they're going to experience. That's fantastic. I hope everyone takes
that away. Even if
they don't
think they're understanding, do it, because something you don't know. So. And I'll tell you what, my son's behaviors immediately went down. I mean, my son was never aggressive, but we used to have behaviors where, well, I'm sure a lot of parents have experienced this, when they try to take their child to the dentist or the hair cutter, places which is very hard for people who have a lot of sensitivities. I could get my son in the car, but I could never get him out of the car. And that's when I understood that this is when I knew that he was understanding everything I said, because I would have, or that he saw something. I knew something was processing, because this is in middle school and we still didn't know what he understood. I would have a schedule up, and I'd always have the icon with the, you know, that said haircut and the icon that said dentist. And I would put those out a week ahead of time, and I'd say, Friday you're going to the dentist, you know, Friday you're getting a haircut, whichever one it was. If I did that and reminded him every day, the day that we had to go, again, I would remind him in the morning, and when he got off the bus, I'd say, okay, we're going now. He wasn't happy about going, but he tolerated it. It's sort of like he prepped himself.
Right.
But if I forgot to put the icons out, if I just got him off the bus and said, you know what, I forgot to tell you, but we have a dentist appointment, there's no way he was getting out of the car when we got to that place. It was like he wasn't able to get himself ready. But it does get better over time because my son now is 19, and I can actually say, or one of the tutors will say to him, you know, your hair's getting long. It's time for a haircut. You feel like a haircut? And he'll say yes or no, depending, but he'll do it. And other days, sure. If I forget that there's a dentist appointment, it's sort of like he's self-regulated himself. This is an important life skill. And I talk about these life skills in my book because of what the adults told me, but if you're going to be living out in the community, no matter where you are on the spectrum, you have to be able to self-regulate yourself, to self-regulate.
Yeah. Very good. You know, that's some great information there. Matter of fact, a little later in the call here, I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the book, a little bit more.
Okay.
I'm sure people would want to, you know, take a look at that book when it comes out. We have another question here from Heather McGee from Marysville. Not sure where that is, but says, my son is in the process of being diagnosed with ASD. He is 2.5 years old right now. How important is it to start a structured school environment before age 3? Our school district does not have classes available before that age.
Okay. It really depends on the child and how they're exhibiting their ASD, because every child is different. But it is important to have some type of structure. And so it is really important. And early intervention is very important. But there are different ways of providing that structure, and I don't know this parent situation, but for example, in California, we're lucky enough in that if we don't have a structured school situation that's available to us, there is early intervention which is provided in the home, and there's other options for therapy, and so we do have some kind of structure, even though it isn't a structured school situation. But it is important to have some kind of structure and to be working on teaching the child. Because, as I said, if they have a hard time making sense of their environment, we need to be creating that sense to the environment for them.
Yes. Okay, we've got another question here from Elaine from Boston. Her question is, can you give advice to parents with newly diagnosed children as the best approach to helping a child with the diagnosis of autism? How should you prioritize your approach?
Oh, wow, that's a really tough one, too. So, because, again, it's that saying, when you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. But how do you prioritize? I think that it's very healthy that this parent is asking this question, because the problem is when you throw everything at once, you don't know what's working for the child.
Right.
That's the first thing. And secondly, you know what? You can't do everything. You may think you're a super parent, and we are all super parents, all of us that are dealing with
right.
this. But you,
yes.
It's sort of like you're going to have to need to be a marathon runner and not a sprinter. And so you can't just go fast. You have to have, as this parent is asking, an approach. So the first thing that I would suggest is when you have a child with autism is to see if there's any medical issues. Now, I would never have said this 20 years ago, but I do say it now because the type of autism that we see now is different from the type of autism that we would see 20 years ago. So, for example, 20 years ago, and these are figures from the Autism Research Institute in San Diego. If 20 years ago, if you had 5 children with autism in a room, 4 of them would have been born autistic, meaning that they never developed properly or normally, I should say, and then 1 who developed normally but then regressed around the age of 18 months to 2 years of age. But now what we're seeing is the opposite. We see if you see 5 kids with autism somewhere, usually 4 of them will have developed normally, and then around 18 months to 2 years have lost the skills that they acquired. And you only see 1 who never developed normally. In other words, appeared autistic from the beginning, or at least developmentally delayed. And so what we are finding, or what people are finding, is that for some of these kids there are medical issues. And I'm not saying all vaccines cause autism and all of this, but I'm saying that what we consider autism now is not is autism, but there are different reasons. Not everybody's autistic for the same reason. For example, my son was born with autism, and I know what his autism comes from. It comes from genetic chromosomal defect. For somebody else, it could be an environmental impact on a chromosomal issue or a genetic predisposition. And so that's why you see this regression. And that this is a theory now. It's not always the vaccines, but it could be something else. So sure. Irregardless of why they're regressing, a lot of these kids also tend to have medical issues. In other words, they have chronic diarrhea, or they have gut problems, or they're constantly crying. Well, maybe they're crying because they're in pain. Maybe they're crying because they're just trying to communicate and they can't get the words out. There's some reason why they're not comfortable. And so I would really suggest to people to look for doctors who have a biomedical background, who have a background on diet. For example, some kids have allergies, and that's the allergies that are making them sick or making them worse. I'm not saying it's causing the autism. I'm saying it's showing, making their autistic symptoms show up more. And so, you first of all, I would say look at the medical aspect to make sure your child is healthy. I would say do some type of structured one-on-one. ABA is the proven method that works, but for some it works better than others. I would suggest some floor time, because floor time takes care of the developmental levels and the emotional. We can't forget the emotional connections. And also have fun. Have fun with your
kids.
We forget the fun sometimes with our kids.
Yes. Matter of fact, I'm glad you touched on ABA.
Fun may not look the same as what we consider fun with our neurotypical kids. You know, you have to kind of figure out what is it that they like and how can I get into that with them.
Sure. Well, that's great. Could you sort of describe what ABA is? People may not have heard of that.
Okay. ABA is Applied Behavior Analysis, and it's all about, it's all based on the theory that whatever we do in life is because we're motivated, and so if you act a certain way or you do something, it's because the consequence is important to you. So you want that reward. So in other words, you work because you're going to earn money, or you work because you enjoy the type of work that you're doing. We do these kinds of talks and volunteer for people because we want to help people. It makes us feel good to do that. So a child is going to learn, if he puts his hand out to touch fire and he gets burned by the fire, he's going to learn not to touch fire if that fire hurts him. And so another thing about applied behavior analysis is you break down all the steps to learn something into little, into separate, discrete steps. And then you teach each step one at a time, and you reward with something positive when they have learned something, if they're going in the right direction. And you keep adding on the skills that way. And first, the rewards are very tangible, like they could be candy or cookies or some video they like to watch. And as they get older, they should internalize those rewards so that they do them because they want to do them.
Right. Okay. Let's see here. We have a question which I'm sure people have experienced this with their children. Her name is Hannah, and she's from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And on here it says, our son screeches a lot when he cannot say what he wants or needs. When he is bored, he's 3 years old and was diagnosed with PDD. He has speech delay. How should we redirect him from yelling?
Okay, so he's screeching because it's with his way of trying to communicate.
Right.
Okay. Well, communication is very important, and so all behavior actually is communication, and that's his way of communicating because he's having a difficult time speaking. It's not coming out quickly enough for him. I always suggest, and research proves that just because you're using some alternative type of communication does not mean that you're going to hinder speech. So I always say that people should teach an alternative way of communicating, which will help beef up the speaking. So, for example, either writing or putting icons together that are pictures or words. This will bolster his speech because it'll get him not to focus so much on the actual muscles and everything like that, that it needs to say something. He'll be focusing on the other part that he's doing, and the speaking part will come more naturally because he'll have the other supports. Or using augmentative communication devices that can speak for him. This all will help him develop speech. It's really, a lot of times parents don't want to use augmentative devices or use an alternative form of communication because they keep saying, well, he's going to speak soon, or they're afraid it's going to keep them from speaking, but the research does not prove that. Research proves that using alternative forms of communication will help bring out the positive communication. And the other, the verbal communication. What I would try and do is when he is screeching, is replace his screeching with the words of what he's trying to say. So, for example, if he's frustrated because he's trying to open the door and he can't open the door, and so he's screaming, say, oh, I want the door open. You know, put words to what he's doing. And sometimes sure. That will help him too.
Okay, very good. Very good. I have another question here. I'm not sure if you can answer this one, but I kind of feel for her. Her name is Brandy, and she's from Vernal, Utah, I believe. And her question is, I have an 8-year-old daughter who has, for the past 2 years, constantly clawed at her skin until she bleeds. She is now covered in scars. The doctor says this is self-mutilation. Any suggestion on how to handle this? I don't know if this is beyond you or not, but
I feel very badly also for the mom. But I don't know what kind of doctor she's seen, if he's not very familiar with, he might be familiar with developmental disability or autism in the sense of having a few patients. But I really, to me, if somebody's clawing away at their skin, it is self-mutilation, but it's because something's bothering them. To me, it's a cry for pain. I don't know if it's a sensory thing with the skin or if there's something going on inside. Maybe they have gut issues. And I really think if I were that person that I would see someone on the Autism Research Institute site, they do have doctors who are experienced in biomedical ways of helping children with autism, and I would look for a doctor like that who understands those things. In saying that, I would be very careful. I'm not trying to push people spending hundreds of thousands of dollars. You have to find a doctor who knows about these things, but who's sensible too, because not all the treatments work for everyone. But to me, if I had a child who was scratching away at their skin, I would think, this kid must be hurting inside. There's something bothering him, and I would try and find what kind of tests that I could do and also see if there are different allergies that this child may have. Okay. That's what I would suggest.
Okay, very good. I'm sure that's going to be a big help to her. We have Chris from California. My son is 2 years old and 2 years and 9 months old, just diagnosed with autism. He is obsessed with touching and eating plants and flowers. He also loves vegetables. Any connection, any idea as to why this is happening?
No, except that I would say that most people would love to have her son. Because most people can't get their kids to eat fruits and vegetables. But I know that's not a really good answer. But I would say, first of all, to be very careful. For example, my son doesn't necessarily always eat plants, but he will, if sometimes take a leaf and put it in his mouth because he loves salad so much. So I had to make sure when we moved into this house that all the plants around the outside were not poisonous. I live in California too. So you have to be careful about the fact that you don't want poisonous plants around. And, again, I don't have any experience as to why this might be happening. You might want to ask the dietitian who's coming on your show in a few weeks.
Yes.
But I would say for my son, it's because he does love fruits and vegetables, and so maybe the leaves look to him like lettuce. And I should ask my son. Those are one of the things that since he's able to communicate to us now, I don't know why I haven't thought about asking him, but I will ask him.
Okay.
But, maybe he
just
likes the color green.
We actually have Janice from Boston. Her question is, one of my son is DX with PDD. He just came from a residential treatment center. He doesn't seem to get along with his younger brother who has DX with Asperger's. And the school suggests a weighted vest. What are your thoughts on the weighted vest?
Oh, my gosh. Okay. The weighted vest is really supposed to be like a calming thing, meaning that perhaps they've realized that he needs, like, some sensory input.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that I know this is like a shortened question because but maybe they're seeing behaviors in him that show that he needs to have some deep pressure and he needs the weighted vest for that. But that doesn't reply why he doesn't get along so well with his brother. I don't know these two children, but I do want to say that there are autism issues and then there are sibling issues. And when I look closely in our family, because I have a daughter who's 16 who's neurotypical, and there's a lot of stuff that has to do with the autism, but you know what? A lot of that stuff is sibling stuff, too, and you just have to kind of try and differentiate between what is because of the autism and what is because of siblings. And that's kind of easy for me to do because I grew up with five brothers and sisters, and we were a lot of different personalities, and so I know what sibling crap is. So I'm not trying to belittle the question, but I'm trying to say that some of the issues that we see are serious, and then some of them are less serious than we think they are because there's a sibling issue that's in there. So it's trying to figure out, are we solving a sibling issue or do we have an autism issue here?
Right. Right. Here's an interesting question here. It's from Debbie from Spring Hill. Her question is, my son was finally diagnosed with AS from in February of 2008 after previously being diagnosed with ADHD and OBD and Tourette syndrome. Is it possible for a child to be successful after years of missed therapies and interventions associated with children on the spectrum? How can you make up for these missed therapies and early interventions when the child was diagnosed with AS at 10 years old?
Okay, well, first of all, usually kids with Asperger's syndrome are diagnosed later, and this is, I don't want to say normal, but let's say it happens a lot that they're diagnosed with ADHD or Tourette's or something else, especially with adults, because adults didn't have the Asperger's syndrome diagnosis available to them. It's only been around for a little over 10 years. Mm-hmm. But ADHD and OCD are kind of seen as an extension of the autism spectrum, and I'm not talking about, I'm not saying this as an MD or a doctor. I'm saying, like, in the field, experts will talk about this and say that it sort of seems like an extension. And so a lot of the things that work with someone with ADHD could also work with someone who has Asperger's, and so I don't feel that because she had a different diagnosis she necessarily missed out on a lot, because especially when it comes to Asperger's, there isn't that much that they do when they're younger. But it's never too late to start. In fact, that's one of the things in interviewing these adults in autism life skills. As I said, there wasn't the diagnosis of Asperger's before, and so many of these adults didn't have a clue. They were misdiagnosed with other things and had no clue they had Asperger's until they were a lot older. And so now they're learning what they needed to learn, and they realize, oh, this is why I have a problem in this particular area, and how can I help myself? And so it's really good that at 10 she has the diagnosis, and now she can actually work towards getting the social skills in there. That's really important, is getting the social skills in and also organizational skills. That's another thing the adults said was so important to them, was organizational skills. Some of our kids on the spectrum have it naturally, you know, the ones who like to line up the cars and the ones who like to do everything exactly in the same order. But most kids don't translate that into organizational skills. And so those need to be taught. And when I talk about organizational skills, you can use color coding. You can use different ways of organizing their work, like on a planner, so that they can see when they have things to do. How do they organize their papers to and from school? This needs to be communication between the teacher and the parent, but there's definitely lots to be done.
All right.
Late.
All right. I have another question here from Lisa Turkington of Columbia, South Carolina. This is an interesting question here. It probably ties into what you've just been talking about. It says, my son has just been diagnosed with high-functioning autism. He is 8 years old, and I've been trying to get a diagnosis since he was 3 when I realized something was wrong. At what age do most high-functioning kids get a diagnosis? What more could I have done to speed along the process so I can help advise other parents?
Okay, the first thing I want to say to all these parents out here who are asking these kinds of questions is that I totally support them, and I totally understand where they're coming from, because I knew there was something wrong with my child, and it took me years to convince people. And your mom, you know when there's something wrong with your child. And
right.
What you have to do is believe in yourself and just know that you're right, okay? You may not know what is wrong with them, and you may not know what to do about it, and that's the whole search, because once you know what's wrong, then you can do something about it. But that's the first thing I want to say. So I want parents to really pat themselves on the back and believe that they are the true expert. Don't let anybody ever tell you that you're not an expert on your child, because you are the expert on your child. The second thing I want to say is you can't, I hate to say should, would, could, but please don't beat yourself up and say, what could I have done? What should I have done that could have speeded up the process? Because you know what? We all do what we think is best at the time, and hindsight is 20/20. It's much too easy. Hey, ladies, you know what I'm talking about. You look at your husbands and you say, why did I marry him? Or aren't I glad I married him? You know, the thing is if you knew what you knew 20 years ago, would you have done the same thing? Or, you know, would you have taken a job now that you hate or a job that you love if you knew what you knew back then? Or what if you knew back then what you know now? So it's the same thing with your children, and even though it's much more serious because you're responsible for your children, you did everything you knew was best. And you can't beat yourself up about what you should have done. And in fact, it's part of my quest in writing this third book, the Autism Life Skills one, where I went and interviewed people on the spectrum, because having Jeremy, who was 19, so I knew he was aging out of the system, and Rebecca, who's neurotypical, who's 16, you know, mm-hmm. You start asking yourself questions as parents, even with just Rebecca, who's neurotypical, but did I do the right thing in raising them? Am I being too strict with Rebecca? Am I being too lenient? Am I not asking her to do too, you know, enough chores at home? And Jeremy, what kind of decisions that I made about him? Should I have had him mainstreamed all the time? Should I have done a different type of therapy than what I did? And I realized in interviewing all these adults that, yes, it's important what you do, but the most important thing that every adult had in their life, every single one of them, and I interviewed people who were very high-functioning or very able to people who were very impacted and who just type on a computer, like Amanda Bags, who was on CNN, and people who are nonverbal like my son. And all of them said the number one thing that was important to their well-being and their outcome as adults was that they had parents that were there for them, a mom or a dad that was there for them by their side the whole time. And so in the end of the day, the therapy was important. I'm not belittling that, but you have to realize that if you've been making the decision that you think is right all along, that your child feels that. And that's what's still going to continue to guide you. And all you can do is think about and analyze what you've done and why you think you should have done it differently and do it now. And you know what? All this talk of, like, windows of opportunities, and if you don't do these therapies by the age of 2, you know, it's all over, that's not true. Early intervention is important, but what's really important is their whole lifespan. They're always continue to grow. I mean, the brain is plastic. And look at people who have car accidents or who are in strokes and then who have, who have to go through rehabilitation and have to work on their physical therapy and getting their bodies back working. That's all the brain cells working. And, you know, people do recuperate, and those are the same brain cells that are going to keep growing with your children. It's never too late.
Right. Well, I'm so glad you said that, that it's never too late. And, you know, just the fact that kids need to have a parent. And on this subject here, since we're halfway through the call, and you sort of touched on your book a little bit. Could you talk a little bit about your book to what people are going to expect when they, you know, finally get their hands on it? It sounds like there's some really interesting stuff there about life skills and sort of looking at autism from the people who've lived it and now are being asked, you know, what their lifespan was all about and how they, you know, what things were helpful to them.
Yeah, I guess because my first two books were really based on research and what does the research say. And I did look at what people on the spectrum said, too. I mean, I have quotes with them throughout the books. And it is very practical. Or both my books, The Autism Spectrum Disorders and also The Adolescents on the Autism Spectrum, are very practical. And this book is it's still practical. I'm sorry, I can't speak. It's practical, but it's from a different perspective. As I said, I was going through this whole thing of like, oh my gosh, I only have 2 years left, because, you know, there's sort of this after, what happens after high school? People kind of, you know, there's nothing out there, and that's another discussion if you want to talk about that a little bit after this. But I thought, what is it that was important to these people growing up? What made them who they are today? And when I talk about people being happier, being successful, I'm not saying, you know, they're driving a nice car and they're earning a lot of money, but people with autism who feel like they are successful. So, for example, Sue Rubin, she's very autistic-like, and she wrote the movie and starred in it that's called Autism is a World, and she communicates by spelling out, but she's very smart. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then you have people on the other end of the spectrum who are very intelligent and can speak really well and, you know, have all kinds of interesting jobs, and but they still have other difficulties in their lives. And I wondered, well, what is it that got them where they are? And for Sue, she is really successful because she has a way of communicating, which she never had before. And her whole life now is open to her because of that. And so all these individuals talk to me about what was it that was important to them for growing up to be the people they are now. What was done, who was important in their lives, and what they wish they would have known sooner. And so these 10 different areas I put into 10 different chapters, and it's actually the subtitle of this book, Autism Life Skills, From Communication and Safety to Self-Esteem and More. 10 essential abilities every child needs and deserves to learn. And the three areas that people spoke the most about was sensory processing, which I already mentioned. The second one was communication. You could be somebody who is nonverbal, or you could be someone who's very intelligent, but you don't get the second meaning, so you're always misunderstood because you don't understand what's really going on in a conversation, because you don't understand the lingo or the metaphors. And safety. Safety was such an issue for many people. Most people said that they were either bullied or made to feel that they were disliked, and many were abused. And some did not even realize that it was abuse because no one had taught them the difference.
Sure.
And so it just made me realize how many things we can do now to prevent some of these situations happening in terms of the safety issues. But also in discussing with them, I realized how much the things that we don't think about, like self-esteem and self-advocacy, these are things we think about in the high school years, but they're actually things people should start teaching to their children when they're little. So what I did in these chapters, it's all the interviews with the adults, and then I put in the little practical tips. So you can read through that as a professional or as a parent and say, wow, that kind of reminds me of my kids. What could have helped that, you know, what could help him in these areas?
Sure.
And it was really mind-boggling for the things I learned. And can I give one example?
Yes, please.
Okay, so here's one example. I noticed that a lot of your questions were from people with really young children, but I have a son who's 19, and so the older parents out there will understand my grief, but I never thought I'd be talking about toileting issues, and my son is 19, okay? And forever, people have always made it feel like the toileting issues is somehow related to being on the less able end of the spectrum. Well, one of the persons who has Asperger's in my book, I'm actually sitting in the lobby at a conference and I'm interviewing her. And I'm not going to mention her by name because then a lot of people, I ask them the same question and they all had the same issue. But all of a sudden I hear this timer go off, you know, like this bell ring, and she says, oh, just a minute, I'll be right back. And she goes off and she comes back, and I just assumed, you know, she had a call to make. And I said, oh, are you okay? You know, everything okay? And she said, oh, that was just my timer reminded me to go to use the bathroom. And I said, excuse me? And she said, oh, I said, you know, you have problems with the bathroom or remembering to use the bathroom? And she said, well, when I'm in crowded areas such as this, I can't feel my body. And so I forget to go use the bathroom, or sometimes I'll just feel it at the very last second. And then because there's a lot of people, I'll have to wait in line, and then I get in the, in the restroom area, in the toilet area, and the toilet paper's on one side where I'm not used to it to be on the, you know, it's confusing, she said. So every time I'm out in public, I set my watch, and so that it reminds me to go use the bathroom, and I go regardless of whether I feel like I have to go or not. So then I started asking many of the people that I interviewed, and I didn't ask everybody. So I don't want people to go and read my book and say, well, all these people have issues. But many of the people in there said they did have problems with feeling their bodies, especially when they were in these overload situations. And that's why many of them do put themselves on a schedule. But you see, if you have Asperger's, you can set your phone or you can set your watch, and no one knows the difference. But when you have a kid like mine who can't set his watch and set the phone, I can set it for him, and we're teaching him now to rely on that, and then eventually, hopefully, one day he'll be able to. But it made me realize how much, again, as I said, the sensory processing affects everybody. We just don't realize to what extent for those who are on the more able end of the spectrum.
Right. That's a great answer.
So anyway, I learned kind of little tidbits like that when I was interviewing people.
Okay, very good. Well, we want to be on the lookout for that book. Could you repeat the title one more time?
Okay. It's called, the main title is Autism Life Skills, and the subtitle is From Communication and Safety to Self-Esteem and More, 10 Essential Abilities Every Child Needs and Deserves to Learn. And actually, it's going on sale October 7th.
And, oh, fantastic. Just in time.
Yeah, and I have not even updated my website. I'm going to be doing that this week. But if people Google my name, they should be able already to see the book on the internet somewhere. And also, I guess I should announce that this Autism File magazine that I'm writing for, the announcement I wanted to make is it's actually going to be the first autism magazine that is in so many stores in Canada and the USA. It's going to be in Barnes & Noble and Borders. 2,000 stores in mid-September, an autism magazine in the stores. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing. Now, what's the name of it? Can you say?
It's called The Autism File, and it has my Absalom Paul column on it, and it's got 138 pages, the premier issue, and it has some articles on biomedical, some articles on educational, some articles on the teen perspective or adults on the spectrum. And I wanted to bring it up, too, because for those who are interested in buying my book, Penguin put an ad in the magazine, and if you buy the magazine, you can actually get 15% off on my book.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Did you hear that, folks? You get 15% off on the book if you get the magazine, which is going to be at Barnes & Noble and Borders, correct?
Yes, and it's the premier issue, which is 132 pages, is $5.99.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's going to be a great magazine
if
people can, especially for that number of pages.
If anybody buys the magazine now, well, you can get my, you can ask, I can even tell you now, you can write questions to me if you want questions answered in the magazine.
Great.
Ask Sean Paul. And there's also a doctor column. The doctor is in, you can ask questions from the doctors.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Hey, that's some great information for everybody out there. I hope you take a look at that magazine when it comes out here in mid-September. We're going to move along with the questions here. Thanks so much for sharing that announcement with us. For those of you that have hung around the call to find out, that's great. Let's see here. There was one woman here. Her name is, I think it's Zerlina from Texas. And this is a great question here. How do I deal with my two boys? My six-year-old has PDD, and my five-year-old does not have it. My five-year-old doesn't understand that his brother needs more attention. That's probably a common situation with a lot of parents.
Yeah, it is such a struggle when you have kids that are on the spectrum and not on the spectrum, because there's always a need for attention. And
yeah.
So it's really hard. I know I've had a terrible time with my daughter because she's 2 years younger than my son. And I find that it really depends on where they are in the pecking order, too. So I know people who have a daughter who's neurotypical, who's the firstborn, and then they have a son with autism, and the daughter naturally likes to be maternal with the son or with her brother. And so those kind of situations really kind of work out because they understand. But a lot of times when it's a different order, or when it's boys, or just different personalities. Like, my daughter is just not, never was a Barbie doll girl, kind of play with dolls. She's a tomboy. And so she never had that wanting to take care of her brother instinct. And we've had a lot of sibling issues, but what we have worked out is, I mean, I've always just explained to her that he needs more attention. But I also make sure that I always have some time with my daughter. So it's hard because there are four, you know, there's mother and father, and then there's
sure.
the kids, and everybody seems to need their own attention. So we have times when we do family things together, and then there are times that I do try to do things alone with my son, and then times that I do things alone with my daughter. And it's really important to keep those lines of communication open, where you have to explain to your child, especially when that little, that just because they get more of your time does not mean that they get any more of your love. And that's an important
right.
thing that you need to be telling them. That, yes, maybe he needs more of my time, but it doesn't mean that he has more of my love. And
yes.
that plus the fact that you spend even, and I know it's hard to find time, but it could even be like 10 minutes at breakfast or 10 minutes when they're going to sleep at night. That little mommy and me time or daddy and me time or whoever it is. But that is so important. But you just have to keep repeating it over and over. And I know my daughter, she's 16. You would think that by now she'd be over it, but I still get the, how come I have to do so many chores and Jeremy doesn't? I mean, how many
right.
times can you say, well, because he's autistic?
Exactly.
But, you know, I always made sure that I taught him a few chores because he has a lot of motor issues and so it's hard, but there are like three things that he can do. Like, without being, he has to be supervised, but not totally prompted. And so I now can say, well, Rebecca, he did the laundry yesterday, or he emptied the dishwasher, or whatever. It, you know, I get into that little, I argue for him because he can.
Right.
But,
right.
you know,
right.
she starts laughing now at this point because she gets it. But I know that
yeah.
it's just, she cares very much about him. And over time, it kind of works itself out as long as you make sure they realize that even though the other child may need more of their time, they do not have more of their love. And that's the important
right.
point.
That's a great point. A great point. We have a question here from John in Mount Vernon, New York. It says, my son is 6 years old with, and 6 years old in DX with PDD NOS. He is very high functioning. He scripts continuously. What is a good redirection technique to stop scripting? And maybe you can sort of describe for people what scripting is.
Oh, yeah. So scripting is when someone is always speaking about, for example, there's a certain show that they really like or a movie that they like. They're constantly talking about that or using that as a basis for communication.
Okay.
And that's kind of a tough one. I mean, tough one for me to answer. I've
okay.
always been told by people like Temple Grandin that if somebody is doing that, it's very good because it shows that they have speech and it shows that they're capable of carrying on conversations. But the redirecting is the hard part, and I'm not very good with those kind of questions. What I would look
okay.
at is some speech people, such as, look him up on the internet, what's her name, Garcia. I'm going to look up this name for you, and I'm going to get back to you on that.
Okay, that's fine.
But the scripting really has to do with maybe using, like, social stories about situations they have and using some of the same scripting things, but focusing it on their situation. But I would rather that they look up somebody else, and I'm looking it up on my computer while I can continue answering the question, because I don't want to say the wrong name.
I understand. I've got another question here from Martha from Denver, and her question is, my son with autism is a very picky eater, and lately he's accepting less variety of food, just milk, fruit, cheese, and spaghetti. Do you know any technique to help him accept new things?
How old is he?
He doesn't say.
Can you repeat it?
Yes, it says, my son with autism is a very picky eater, and lately he is accepting less variety of food. And she says it's only milk, fruit, cheese, and spaghetti. And she's asking, do you know of any technique to help him accept new things, new food to eat, I'm going to say.
Okay, well, the first thing that I would look at is there might be a reason why he's only eating those things, and so it's important to find out if he's only eating those things because of the texture or the color or those kinds of things, or maybe there's other issues that we're not aware of in terms of medical and diet, and that would be a good question for the diet person that you're going to have on. I would ask her that. But I know that there are ways of getting people to change some of their diet. But first, I'd look to see if there's a medical problem. If there's no medical problem, then it's all about pairing, for example, when he has his favorite items, to just have him agree to have one spoonful or one forkful, and then he can go back to the other items and see over time if you can slip in one more bite of an unwanted food. But the fact that he used to like things and then he doesn't, that kind of concerns me, and I would want to see what there's going on medically speaking.
Right. So she should really seek the help of a professional in that particular area.
Right. And there's a book out there, and I, again, that's one that I have to look, because my books are all out in the hallway. And I'm going to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write down, do you have the emails of these people?
Yes, I do.
Because I can write down that, the one for the scripting.
Yes.
I want to answer that one. And also, because I can just give them the name of the book and the author. And also the one about the eating, there's a book out there about seeing the difference between when it is just an eating disorder due to a medical situation, or when it's you can actually get them to eat more foods, and how do you go about doing that, and also the scripting. Will you afterwards give me their emails?
Yes, I'll definitely do that.
Okay.
Okay, we've got another person here, Michelle Hamm from Lake, Minnesota. Her question is, my 8-year-old son does quite a bit of hand flapping and running back and forth down the hallway or around the table. Why does he do this? And she wants to know, is this beneficial, or should she find a way to make him stop what, you know, he's doing, and what suggestions might you have?
Okay. So if you talk to people who are really into behavior therapy, applied behavior analysis, they will say, oh, no, you have to teach them to stop that. They need to do some appropriate behavior because it's not appropriate to do that. If you spoke to a lot of the people on the spectrum that I spoke to for writing my book, Autism Life Skills, they would say they're doing that because they need to do that. So I think that there's a happy medium, and this is how I have handled it, because my son, he does other things that are sort of like the running around and the arm flapping that aren't very appropriate, that look kind of strange when you're out in public, is I've taught my son not to do those behaviors out in public, and given him other little things he can do. And, of course, there are exceptions to the rule. Like, sometimes you just can't help it. If I have to drag him around to different stores, when he was little, if I had to drag him around to a lot of different stores, after a while, he couldn't help but do that. If I couldn't give him some smaller kind of behavior that was less noticeable. But now he's a lot older, And he knows that he can do those behaviors at home. So, for example, when I talked about giving him an alternative form of behavior in public, is now in my son, what he likes to do is he likes to stand and rock and, like, play with a piece of string and twiddle a piece of string. Well, I have discovered that it's a visual thing for him, the moving the string back and forth, and I've been able to replace that with a book. So when we go out in public, he will carry a book, and it's kind of more age-appropriate book. So that's his little security thing. And so sometimes he'll still rock, but he's holding a book. It doesn't look quite as strange. Now, if I'm going into stores and I absolutely have to take him with me and there's a lot of fluorescent lighting and a lot of noise and I know it's going to be tough, I always have in my pants pockets, my blue jean pockets, a little tiny piece of string. Not a really big one, but a little tiny one. Because otherwise, if he sees all the tags on the clothes, he's going to want to grab those. But if I give him a little tiny string. But first I try the book, okay? Now, at home, the rule about it at home is that he can do it, but he can't constantly do it. But and also, for example, now he's finishing his high school diploma, which is another interesting thing I'd like to encourage people about and talk to you about that in a little bit. But at home, he has to listen to us read textbooks to him because that's how he can't visually process the information, and he won't listen to books on tape unless they're my voice or his favorite tutor's voices. So someone ends up reading the book to him, because otherwise, with even the tape on, he leaves the room. So he will stand and be rocking in his room, and then we, with the rapid prompting method, we ask him questions to make sure he's been listening, and he has to write his summaries and things like that. And sometimes he will continue to want to stand. And that means, you know, he takes a piece of string or something, and he's, like, flapping it around. Well, if he can still put out the information and he can type and he's paying and he's focusing, then I allow him to do it. But if he's not, if it's interfering with the work, then I'd allow him to do it. But at school, he's not allowed to stem in the classroom. So it's kind of funny because on MTV True Life, they showed him stemming at school and I almost died because we don't allow, you know, that was the big thing. He wasn't supposed to be doing that at school. But I guess it was because MTV was there and Jeremy was nervous with the crew and the aide was nervous that she was going to look bad and, you know, all this kind of thing. But the thing about those behaviors, again, is I would find out why is he doing it. For Jeremy, it's because he's anxious and that kind of helps him with that. But I know that there are kids that do have medical issues where they have pain in their guts, so you have to look. Are they sick or are they not sick? And that, why are they doing the behavior? It's the number one question.
Gotcha. Well, great, great answer. And I've got it. That comes up to a pretty important question I have here from Keenan from upstate New York. And I'm sure parents have experienced this before. Their question is our 10-year-old son is just beginning to potty train. He is able to request the potty train, but only after he's had an accident. How do we get him to ask prior?
See, I know for her it must be very upsetting because she's asking for it afterwards, but you have to look at that as a positive because he's actually made the connection between the potty and the having an accident. In other words, he's made the connection that that's what the potty's for, is for toileting, right? Yes. So I don't know the background here, like if they've done toilet training where he had to sit on the toilet until he went. Until he did something and then got rewarded for that, because that's how he would associate getting rewarded with the toilet, with going on the potty. That's one thing, but maybe they've already done all that. And I think that maybe in this case, too, is the child not feeling that he has to go until it's too late. Remember when we talked about that issue of not being able to feel whether they have to use the restroom or not? And so we've had some issues like that with my son as he gets older, is he will go to the bathroom or he'll look down and be really surprised that he's starting to pee, and then he'll run to the bathroom to finish. And so I suggest in those areas that you actually have a schedule where they're you know, with my son, we sometimes he self-initiates, but we have a reminder. So I think that she should look at the schedule of what, how often is he having these accidents? Okay, chart that over a two-week period of time at home and at school if she can get the staff at school to do it too. And note how much time is passing between accidents. And what you do is just prompt him to use the toilet before the accident and then reward him, well, before the time he would normally have the accident, and then have him sit on the toilet and go and then reward him for going.
Right.
And then eventually he will go on the to the potty on his own.
Okay. Great answer. Because I know that's a common question people have. And the most difficult thing, I guess, parents have who are trying to train a child who has autism, sort of how to deal with the whole issue of potty training. I know that's a lot of work for a lot of people.
Yeah. All the self-care issues are so hard.
Yes. Well, let's see here. We're coming up here on the last half hour, actually. I can't believe it's been an hour and a half. But let's see here. We've got, let me see if I can pick a few more questions here. Okay, here we go. Here's one that I'm sure a lot of people are facing. Her name is Amanda, and she's from Cambridge. I'm guessing that's Cambridge, Massachusetts. I'm looking for advice for when my son starts school for dealing with other kids, either teasing or making fun of them or even bullying them because he's different from the other kids. That's a great question.
It is a great question. And, okay, my first advice to parents, because I know that a lot of times parents, they don't want the other children or the teachers to know that their child has a diagnosis or that there's something. And I don't know about this particular case because I don't know if this is an issue here or not. But the first thing I would do is that immediately have either the mom, I'm not quite sure how old this child is, but have the mom write a short note that the teacher can read to the class that is really giving advice, showing what autism is in a positive way, or Asperger's in a positive way. So, for example, you know, my child might do this a little differently, but then he's really good at this. Or some of the reasons why he acts the way he does, but, you know, just like very nonchalant about it, not in a negative fashion, but if there's anything positive they can say. And I'm saying this knowing that sometimes when they're little, it's hard to know that there's anything positive. I mean, some kids do have a talent that people know right away. Others don't. My son is one of those, you know, we don't know if he has any talents. But I think that what I have experienced and what I've heard from people is that kids bully because they're afraid of what they don't know and what they don't understand. And if people knew why somebody is different or in what way he's different, then a lot of that bullying stops. And also, you need to make sure that the school is behind you and that the teacher is not going to support any kids that are doing any bullying. There is a person on the spectrum who writes about bullying, and his name is Nick Dubin, D-U-B-I-N.
Can you spell that maybe?
D-U-B-I-N.
Okay.
Nick. And he writes, he has a book out, and he does write also on his website about bullying. But that is the main thing that everyone on the spectrum that I interviewed for the book said. And remember, these are people who admit that they have autism, and so they're happy to talk about it. And they say that it would have been so much easier when they were younger if people knew what they had and why they had
right.
it, and if they felt supported by the school staff in this area.
Right.
And I think that you need to explain to your son that sometimes people are not nice, but not linking it to him and his autism, but just it's true that sometimes people just are not nice, period. There are people out there who are just, you know, it doesn't matter what country you're in, there are always people who are not nice. And you just have to
right.
explain that, you have to explain, because that's the reality of life. You're not going to be able to protect your child. He has to know that, but yet know that it's not right.
Right. Very good. Man, this is really good stuff here. We got a few more questions though coming in. They just keep coming in here. Let's see. Here's one. My son also has been having difficulty in public. Her name is Renee from Newark, California. I took all three of my children to a store, and my son became very upset at first. I couldn't figure out what it was that was making him upset. He seemed to be focusing on the pattern on the floor. How can I help him feel more comfortable?
Okay. Now, I don't know his son, but I've had I've had a lot of people talk to me about this, and I have people on the spectrum as well. And a lot of times fluorescent lighting is a big problem. And so you might not notice it in some stores because it's less intense fluorescent. And I'm just guessing this because she's saying that he was focusing on the patterns on the floor. Well, if it's really bright lighting and it's shining off the pattern or making the pattern look more intense, he's obviously focusing in on certain things in the environment. So if it's bothering him, or obviously it's a problem because if he's focusing and he needs to get away because he can't leave that certain spot or she can't get on with her day, if he's able to wear some kind of tinted lenses like sunglasses, sometimes that helps, or a baseball cap, which keeps the fluorescent lights out of the eyes. Of course, I'm all guessing that it has to do with fluorescent lighting or being in a place that's very crowded. And a lot of times, again, it has to do with preparing someone before they go. So talking about where we're going and what store we're going to, and also if it's helpful to wear the hat and the sunglasses, if he will tolerate those. Another thing to do is to remember to tell people how long they're going to be in a certain situation. Because sometimes we forget that and we say, well, we're just going to pop in the store for a minute, and it's not really a minute. We're going to be in there 10 minutes, or maybe we're going to be in there half an hour. Some people can handle it for a certain amount of time, but they can't for longer. And so they need to know. And even if they don't get it the first few times, eventually over time they will understand it.
Okay. Hey, I've got this great question here from Tess in Ventura, California.
Sometimes you get specific answers because if you don't really know what the child is like everywhere.
Right.
But I'm just guesses here.
Okay. That's good enough. You know, people want this information here. And I've got a great question here from Tess in Ventura, California. She said, how can I get my school district to give my child individual one-on-one occupational therapy and one-on-one speech? They tend to push for group occupational therapy and group speech, which would not work for my son.
Okay, well, what this person needs to do is to get an assessment by a speech and language pathologist who specialized in autism, and also an occupational therapist but who knows and is trained in sensory integration. And those are those assessments, then the school district will have to take her request more seriously. Because it will have been a professional who is saying that this is necessary. Well, the first thing that she can do, too, if she doesn't have any resources, is to ask the school district to do an assessment. And if the assessment doesn't come out in a positive, in the way that she is in agreement with, then she has the right to get her own assessment done. But then she would have to pay for that. But sometimes the school assessment is going to be enough. It all depends on the situation in the school district and which professionals they use. Because sometimes they go to the same person who's going to write the same kind of report and not going to argue against, you know what I'm saying? You have to make sure you go to the professional. But sometimes you can't ask them to get an assessment from the person you want. You can ask them to do an assessment, but if you're not happy with their assessment, then you can go get your own assessment as well.
Gotcha.
But that's
gotcha.
The only way you're going to do it. You're not going to be able to argue it without an assessment.
Right. Really good. Well, that's going to be a great thing for her to do, to go ahead and get those assessments, and so she can push to get the individual one-on-one. That's fantastic.
Yeah, but I understand exactly what she's saying because my son always had OT for a certain amount of time, and then as soon as he hit, here at the one school district, stopped at fifth grade, and then sixth grade was another school district, you know, because they split after the grammar school. And all of a sudden, somewhere in fifth grade and sixth grade, my son must have been cured of his occupational therapy needs because they said, oh, no, we don't do OT anymore. I said, what do you mean you don't do OT anymore? My son still has the same problems. Oh, we don't offer it, you know, for at this age. Well, why don't you offer it? Well, because it's only good when they're young. I'm saying, well, what kind of reasoning is that? Because someone's in a car accident when they're older, they give them occupational therapy and physical therapy because it helps. So why wouldn't it help? So, you know, I had to get an assessment. I had to get someone to show that the occupational therapy would still be valid for my son, and then the school district had to provide it. But it was kind of interesting because that was just based on an age thing.
Right. Well, I've got a question here that I'm sure that is right down your alley for sure, because it relates kind of to your new book. Patty from Chicago asks, can you give some sources of materials or books on teaching organizational skills?
Okay. I can give a book in general that's not just for organizational skills, but it has great great ideas, and irregardless of your child, whether it's Asperger's or not. And there are two books, one for elementary schools and one for adolescents. And it's really about school success. And I'm looking up the title now in my autism book while I speak.
Okay.
Because I have so many titles in my head, I can't remember them all by heart. But there are these books are for Asperger's and how to be successful at school. So there are a lot of organizational techniques, and you can translate them into life at home as well. And so, let me look up the name of this author here. You know, it's kind of interesting, but my brain's not working as well as normally because of the day that I've had.
Yes, I know. You did have a rough day.
Well, you know, it's just part of being a parent with a child on the spectrum.
So, it sure is.
Okay. Go ahead and ask me another question, and I'm going to answer this when I find the title
of
the book.
Here's a great question here from Alice. She's from New York and says, what's the best way to request home therapy services, ABA, from the school district if the child hasn't had early prevention services in the home and the child is 8 years old?
What state is this?
New York.
You know what? I can't really answer that because it really depends on the school system you're in.
Okay.
Even though the laws are federal laws, the state is allowed to translate it into and apply it in their way, and that's going to be a great question for the attorney.
Right,
because
right.
Because he's able to tell you where to get advice on that.
Okay. You know, I have another question here from a woman who's a grandmother, and she asks, what can she do to best help out her grandson who has autism? I get a lot of this. I get this a lot, actually, from people who have
grandparents. I'm going to ask that. That's a really good question. I'm going to answer that in a second, but I found the book I was looking for.
Okay,
it's called
good.
For about the organizational strategies. It's called Asperger's Syndrome and Adolescence, Practical Solutions for School Success. And that's by Brenda Smith Miles, M-Y-L-E-S. Asperger's Syndrome and Adolescence, Practical Solutions for School Success. And you may say, oh, my kid doesn't have Asperger's syndrome, or, you know, I'm not really worried about school, but there's tons of hints in there about organizational strategies, and I've actually incorporated a lot of those for my son at home for things because I'm kind of organized in my own way, but I had a hard time figuring out how to organize it in a sense that would help him. And this has been really good for giving me a lot of ideas. So I would suggest it for all types of kids. And resources like that are listed in my Adolescence on the Autism Spectrum book, so I'm really sorry that I am not remembering the titles in my head, but I guess many times because they're written down somewhere, I forget them. Okay, so grandparents and how they can support their children. This is such a good question, because it really shows that grandparents are trying to be supportive in the best way that they can. The first thing that I would say is if there's any way possibly that you can provide any respite for your children. So that means that you would need to learn some techniques for dealing with the grandchildren.
Yeah.
I say that because some of them may have behavior issues or toileting challenges or things like that. If there's any way that you could actually handle the child for an hour or two a week, I'm sure that's one area that would be really useful. If that's not possible because you live far away or it's just not possible, another area is if you are able to visit your children or your child who has the autistic grandchild, is to find one thing you can do with that child to connect. So, for example,
right.
if they're teaching their child using a certain kind of therapy, they might be teaching the child a skill like catching a ball or coloring in or some kind of little skill like that. I say little skill, but it's a very important skill and it's very hard to teach because it needs repetition. If you could
mm-hmm.
just do that little thing with them, that's a way for you to connect with your grandchild and also will help your son or daughter. And the other thing is just really being there for them. And it's so very hard sometimes not to try not to offer advice because, you know, as parents, we do have a lot of, you were a parent, and so you have a lot of things to offer. But
sure.
it is so difficult having a child with autism that it kind of goes out of the realm of neurotypical child rearing. And so just the fact that you're there and open to listening to your child, to your adult child, and also, really, if you could just spend time, time is something that they are very short on.
Yes, it is. Well, let's see here. We've got another question here, which you could probably have some insight on. Her name is Cheryl Lee from Reynoldsburg, Ohio. And her question is, is there a good discipline plan to follow for children with PDD to teach them to be a part of society? My son is 5.
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question? Is there a what?
Yes, is there a good discipline plan to follow for children with PDD to teach them to be a part of society? And her son is 5 years old.
Right. Well, there isn't like a plan written in stone. It really is the things that are going to be important to be a part of society, and these are things that I learned in my work that I've done, but also was really pointed out to me by the adults that I interviewed in Autism Life Skills. It's self-regulation.
Mm-hmm.
What do I mean by self-regulation? Self-regulation means that you have to be able to control your responses to things. And I mean responses in terms of an emotional response and also in terms of sensory overload responses. For this to happen, and this can start when they're young, as like at 5, when you see that a child becomes overwhelmed, either emotionally or with the sensory overload, you teach them at first of all, you have to be able to recognize when it is they're reaching that saturation point. And when they're in the throes of that, you don't discuss that. But once they're out of it, that's the time using social stories that you discuss with them. What did it feel like when they, right before that they had that overwhelm moment, that emotional outburst, or that, you know, that time that they couldn't control themselves anymore. And then over time, this is all about self-awareness. So if it's an emotional overload problem, you have to teach them about recognizing emotions in themselves and others. A lot of times kids will go stare at babies that are crying and they laugh because they think it's really funny. Well, you have to explain what those tears are. You have to explain what happy looks like, what sad looks like, what anger is.
Yeah.
You also give them numbers to their emotions and to their overwhelmed situation so that when their engine is too high, or their engine is too low, that doesn't feel right, but when it's just right. And eventually over time, they learn, you can teach them techniques to do when they're overloaded or emotionally overloaded.
Right.
And then that's how they learn to self-regulate, because unless they can self-regulate, they're not going to be welcome in society, or they're not going to have a fun time in society, because people don't want to be around people. People are afraid of people who can't control themselves. So that's the number one life skill. The second thing is self-advocacy, learning to speak up for yourself about what you need and want, but in a polite way. And that also starts when you're young by ordering in the restaurants, being able to say what it is that you like and you don't like, to show that your choice is respected. And parents need to build that in as kids get older. So, for example, when my son comes home from school now and he's a teenager, I don't have a schedule all set out for him, like what he has to do when. You know, here are the things you need to do today. What order do you want to do them in? You figure out when you want it done. And then we have to help him and prompt him through them, but he chooses the order. He has more choice now because he's older. And so it's really about becoming self-reliant in all these different ways and teaching him organizational skills. So there is not like one master plan. It's really about teaching those good life skills, which is why I wrote that book. And I don't want to sound like I'm plugging my book. It's just realize that these are the life skills that we never think about, because we're always talking about teaching them, look at me, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. But those things are not the things that count when you grow up. The things that count when you grow up are self-advocacy, self-esteem, self-regulation, those kind of skills.
Right. Fantastic. That says it all right there. I like the way you put that. I really do. You talk a little bit about...
Before you go on to the questions, can I say something about, because I thought it would be kind of encouraging for people, about my son Jeremy, who's 19 now, and it wasn't until 5 years ago that he could communicate by spelling out on a letterboard, and it's not facilitated. We're not holding his arm or anything, but it is assisted in that someone has to hold the letterboard, but he does it with 6 or 7 people fluently, and then there's new people he's learning to do this with. The point is that up until 5 years ago, we had no idea how much he understood about what was going on around him. And it turns out that he's an auditory learner. Well, he is now finishing up high school. He has 8 more classes to go. If anybody had told me 2 years ago that my son would be getting a high school diploma, I mean earning a high school diploma, and passing the tests and everything, I would never have believed it. Now, it wasn't a goal for me, for my son, that he had to have a high school diploma. But it's just amazing that is where my son is now. But yes, he's very autistic, and yes, he still has toileting issues, and yes, you know, we're working on all the life skills, but he's smart, and he can communicate. And he is such a happy camper because he can communicate. And we made sure that, I think the big thing you want to make sure that your kids don't have problems with is aggression. If you have a child who's aggressive, that's why you need to find out why they're aggressive. Is it because they're hurting, because they're angry, because they're sick, or just lack of communication skills that makes them so upset? That it's getting, finding out the source of that and turning them around from being angry to being a little happier. And it's, I'm not saying this... I'm not saying that it's easy, you know, and my son didn't just one day type. This was over many years of sitting in, I always insisted he'd be main students for 2 of his classes, so he was always listening, and, you know, and I kept hearing, well, he's not taking anything in, why are you doing that? And I would say, well, he has to learn to sit in public, he has to learn to sit with a group of people, because he has to sit in the movie theater, and he has to sit in a waiting room. You know, I kind of based it on that, not on his educational need, because I didn't have any proof of educational attainment in terms of my son. And all those years he was listening. And so, you know, the teaching him to spell out on the letterboard and to type and all that, that took many years too. So it wasn't an overnight process, but he would never have been able to get there if I hadn't given him the opportunity to be, to hear and to be in with a group of neurotypical kids. And so I always had half in mainstream and half in special ed because he needed both. But I just want to say to parents, you can never give up. And
right.
It isn't the high school diploma, but it's the fact that he wants to learn. And now this is what he's doing. He's learning, and he's going to have a high school diploma. And to me, that's the...
So now, when does he graduate?
It'll be in 2 years.
2 years. That'll be a great day.
Eight more classes, and he can handle two classes a semester. So that's going to be it. And he still has to do some vocational stuff. But,
very good.
You know, and the thing is I fought long and hard, and I now have a group. It wouldn't have happened if the district people hadn't changed. There's new district people there, and I managed to find the right professional who it works with people who have the severe communication difficulties like my son. And it was very validating to find out that everybody is behind my son. You know, it's more like I taught my son, and then my son convinced them. It wasn't me.
Yeah.
It was my son who convinced them.
Yeah. Wonderful. That's a wonderful story. It really is. That's going to bring a lot of encouragement to a lot of people. I have another question here from Dan from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. He says his son has two conditions. I can't exactly pronounce the first one, but it's in general, it's a question about insurance. And I know there's been a lot of debate here about, you know, whether insurance will cover for some of the treatments for autism. Could you elaborate on that and kind of what's happening and, you know, what's the latest thing that you've been hearing?
Well, the latest I've been hearing is that, A, it really depends on the insurance company, and, B, it depends on the state you live in, too, because there have been many states who have been ratifying or putting acts into effect about how people can't be refused for certain things and how certain conditions have to be covered. And so I really can't answer that question because I have no idea about South Dakota. And so, and even when you are in a state where you know what the rules are, it's very confusing because we all know that insurance, I hope I'm not insulting anybody out there who works in the insurance field, but it's very complicated. And I find that oftentimes you may get refused with something and you have to keep plugging away and asking. One thing that I do know is that there is an Autism Insurance Yahoo group out there, and I would suggest that this person link up to that because there's a lot of discussion and information sharing. It's an Autism Insurance Yahoo group.
Okay, yes, they can Google that and get a chance to link up to that and get some information from there.
Yeah. I'm really sorry that I can't answer, but I'd rather tell you that I can't answer the wrong thing.
Yes, it's okay, you know. We're kind of, you know, just rolling along here because I've got just a few more that have come in here. Her name is Renee, and once again, she's from Newark, California. I think it's the same one who called in earlier. Did you change your son's diet? I've heard that a dairy-free and gluten-free diet helps children with autism, and I know this is going to be a subject coming up here next Wednesday, actually, but... could you elaborate on it a little bit? I guess he wants to know what your son's diet issues were or how you changed his diet.
My son is very much like the typical canner autistic child who never develops properly. And I have to say that I have tried the diet with my son, and I have tried other kinds of biomedical treatments, and very little has worked with my son, but my son is as healthy as a horse. And my son doesn't have any of the issues that a lot of kids with autism have these days. But I will say that I know for a fact from many people that I see that the diet has helped. And what I like about the diet is it's something you can try and that you don't, it's a lot of work and you might spend some money, but it's something that actually, you don't have to go see a doctor and spend thousands of dollars and then wonder if you went to the wrong doctor. You can actually get a couple of good books and remove, you just have to do it correctly and make sure that you remove everything and try it for a month and see if it makes a difference. And you can get tests done, too, so you can get the testing. But in my mind, this is one of the first things to try just because it's been helpful for so many people. But, again, we're learning, the experts are really believing that autism is really caused by many different things, and that's why you're not going to find one thing that works for everyone. Because remember, autism is not diagnosed through a test. It's diagnosed through the observation of symptoms, so behaviors. We say, oh, if you have these kinds of behaviors, then you have autism. But why are you acting that way? You could have many different reasons why your child is showing autistic symptoms. So, for example, somebody who is sick from mercury poisoning, from, you know, the vaccines, or just over vaccines because they have an immune system that didn't work, they may be showing the same behaviors as someone like my son who is autistic for a different reason or has autistic symptoms for a different reason. So the diet's going to work great for some people, and it's not going to work for others. But I say for anything that doesn't cost you an arm and a leg or that doesn't make you mortgage your house and that makes sense for your child, I would go and try it if it's not going to hurt them. Like, for example, because my son has sensitive hearing to noises, I tried auditory integration training because that made sense for my son's problem. If you have a child who has no issues with auditory processing, it makes no sense. And it's the same kind of thing with a lot of therapies. But the diet one is one I would wholeheartedly tell everybody to give it a shot.
Okay. Well, we're coming up here with just 2 minutes and 40 seconds left on the call.
Talk fast.
I just have one, I guess it's the final question, which seems really appropriate here, is Trish from Albany, New York asks, what do you think is the most important thing you learned from being a mother of a child on the spectrum?
Gosh, that's a really, really loaded question. I'm not one of these people who says, oh, if it weren't for autism, I would never have met all these wonderful people. You know, or someone had written this poem once that says something about having a child with autism is like you're getting on a plane because you're going to Italy, but when you wake up and the plane lands, you're not in Italy, you're in Holland. But Holland is nice, too. I don't really believe that way because I think I would have known a lot of nice people without having a child with autism. But I do believe that having a child with autism has really shown me what is important in life. You know, there's nothing like when your child does a little step in the positive direction of learning something and you see that light bulb go on over their head, or you realize that your child has moved one step up in a certain direction towards independence or understanding, and you think, or you found something that really helps your child in terms of a biomedical technique or a strategy, and it's making such a difference in your child, and you think, wow, you know, that's what's important in life. It doesn't matter what kind of car you drive. It doesn't matter, you know, what kind of clothes you have. What really matters is those little things. And really, I'm taking things day by day is what I've learned with a child with autism. And not getting, you have those days where you're so upset because everything's going wrong, but then you have those days where, you know, you see that little glimmer of sunshine. And that's what I've really learned from having a child with autism.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for telling us that. And we're coming up here on the end of the call. And I just want to say that for everyone who's been on the call, thank you so much for calling. We want to thank Chantel for coming in and taking their time out of her busy day to come in and talk to us all. And for all of you that are on the call, if you could, there's a link at the bottom there on the page that says give us a testimony. We'd love to hear what you think about the call and get your feedback. What things we could do differently, what things we could do better. And once again, Chantel, thank you so very much for spending the time with us today.